Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Yo is the way I greet everybody.
Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Oh, is how I've been known to greet everybody.
And joining Brian, I was waiting for him to take a big sip, Captain Murphy himself.
Jason, funny noise here. I don't have anything.
Like, how does this go? Jason Murphy in the studio with Brian.
Yeah, man. We didn't know for sure, since this was Justin's big bachelor party weekend, whether or not he would be, well, A, alive, or B, capable of joining us. So we, since Jason was over here, we thought we'd bring him back to the show. You've been on the show before, right?
Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, it's okay. No. Go ahead.
I like that Justin's pinch hitters are two Irish guys.
That's how we go.
The only time I was on here was years ago, when Andrew couldn't show up.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. I bet that was a train wreck.
It was kind of awful.
That was back when we thought that could happen.
We started stabbing at each other and trying to fight for gas. And
well, you guys might have to step up, because I think next Sunday I am going to be traveling through the air during the time. So.
Uh-oh. All right. We'll figure something out.
Going to go to Nuevo York. Go see two upstarts make their Broadway debut.
Oh, doggone it. Are you going to see Penn & Teller on Broadway?
I am, sir.
I wanted to see if I could take Bonnie, and Bonnie's schedule didn't permit. I was like, oh, well. But then, like, now I have the itch where it's like, maybe I'll just up and spend points and just run out. When are you going next Sunday?
The third is when I'm going to see, right, maybe, Sunday. Okay. Yeah, I made a choice between either, like, my best friend in the world, you know, my hetero soulmate's bachelor party, or next week going to see Penn and Teller.
Well.
Fine. No, it's great. Great. well, actually, we'll put together a little special episode of the show, because Brian and I will be in Utah for Nerdtacular.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So if it's the third, I can't. But I just wonder if there's some point during the run I can run up there for just a night and turn around and come back.
This is a great new segment on the show called Brian's Google Calendar.
That's right.
Interactive tour through when Brian's busy and when he has available time.
I'm going to jump right
just
in
says
here,
Hearthstone.
Folks. For audio listeners, you probably can pick it up in the tone of my voice. You can probably sense it. There's probably some way in which it's been affected. For those of you watching right now, there may be a glow about me.
I mean, you do. You look flushed. You look frothy.
You look radiant.
You look like freshly churned butter.
Guys, what have you done with your hair?
You look like you're ready to fight Shonuff.
That was fantastic, Sam's. I'm not quite ready to fight Show Enough, okay? Need Bruce Leroy for that. I had an experience, folks. I had a transcendent, incredible experience Friday by myself. Well, nobody was within arm's distance of me.
Practically by yourself.
Yes.
Yeah, by 1880s standards, you were alone in the wilderness.
So we've talked about virtual reality before, and we've talked about experiences doing Oculus Rift. And I like how when you talk about the different headsets, it's like you're talking about drugs, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, have you done Molly? Yeah. Have you done the Galaxy Gear? Yeah, you know, I'm going to get some X, you know?
Have you done
so
Red Beavis?
Like, we've all done Oculus, right?
No, I still have not. The closest I have come. Yeah, I've not done Oculus. The closest I've come was when I accidentally stole Justin's Google Cardboard thing, built it, made it, tried it, thought it was cool, dude, and that's all I've done.
Come to rate select, Jeff has an Oculus dev kit.
All right.
Yeah. Duh. Dumbass. So we've done that, tried that. I mean, those of us here, and then you've tried like the cardboard, and you can actually on Amazon, you can buy like the new upgraded cardboard that'll let you use the iPhone, because now cardboard works on iOS too. And so, like, I just ordered for $20 one that's a plastic one that fits over your head. But I'm not here to talk about that. I went down to Venice Beach, you know, the new Silicon Beach, and I went to a place called WeVR, W-E-V-R, and they were doing an open house. And what they're working on is they're working on a platform. So if you want to create content more like immersive video content and you want to make sure that it's going to output to whatever formats, because right now in the space to control your eyeballs, we know about Oculus Rift, which is now a Facebook company. We know about Samsung has the Gear, which you plug your phone into and you can do that. And there's the Google Cardboard, which you can do. There is coming out, you know, we know, of course, Microsoft has augmented reality with HoloLens. That's another system. And then there's been talk about HTC, the company came out with that, announced Vive, and they partnered with Steam. As you know, Steam, which is the big, huge video game distribution platform. So Steam said, hey, we'll handle the software. You guys handle the hardware. Let's put our peanut butter and chocolate together and see what kind of magic we can make. And they unveiled this. And everybody has a slightly different approach. You know, Oculus is kind of like it's developed by hardcore gamers. You know, you've got Palmer Luckey, you've got John Carmack, you know, legendary gamer. They've developed a system. I have Rev 2 development kit and played with that, and it's really cool tech. I got my first chance to try the HTC Vive on Friday.
So, and just to further fill out how crowded this market is, Sony has done Morpheus, right?
Morpheus, correct. That's the other one I forgot to add.
So this
yeah.
is pretty much anybody who wants to plant a flag in video games specifically for the next 10 years is taking a stab
at a
big top shelf virtual reality headset.
I have one
right now.
It's beer goggles.
that's your yeah. development. It alters your reality.
Yeah.
Real quick, I heard you rattle off a bunch of them. In there was both HoloLens and the Magic Leap, or is that a different category for you?
Nobody has tried Magic Leap outside of a laboratory, and there's no shipping date yet. And those HoloLens and Magic Leap are augmented reality, where right. you see the world around you and it overlays. The other ones, which you know, Morpheus, Gear, Oculus, and Vive are all immersive. Just shut out the world, you're in there, right? So I got to do the Vive demo. Now, what makes this different is when you normally do the Oculus, you're sitting down. There's a little tracker that sees which way your head is moving in space, 3D space. But it's kind of a state as it is right now. It's a stationary experience, and they haven't really defined the controller. What they did with the Vive, and the Vive will probably be – they're saying the Vive is going to be more expensive, be much more expensive. But the Vive is you put this headset on. You have these two wands with these things you can click with these octagonal little sensors on top of it that are really good for sensing in space. And you put two sensors up on your walls near your ceiling in your room. What this does is it tracks your head and your movement in three-dimensional space so you can stand and you can walk around. If you approach a wall, this blue grid flashes in front of you that's like
– oh, that lets you know that you're about to encounter an object in real space.
Yes, oh, yes, wow. Exactly. So you can say my room is this big, my room is X big or whatever like that. But what it does is instead of you sitting there and feeling like you're popping your head into a 3D world, it puts that 3D world around where you are. So I'm waiting in line to go do this thing. And I'm like, listen, guys, I've done Oculus.
Yeah, but, you've already picked a team in this. You're like, sorry, bro. I understand it's called the Pepsi Challenge, but I'm a Coke man and I'm always going to be a Coke man.
I didn't pick, but I'm like. Every experience I've done has been sort of incremental. Like, oh, this is cool. In the Oculus, I go like, oh, this is cool. I can see like if I was a gamer, I would love this. You know, an Oculus Rift would be great. I've seen like if I were a gamer, this would be a cool way to play this. Put on the Vive, right? The Vive comes on, thing goes up. And now I'm like looking around and I'm used to kind of like Oculus sort of just sort of looking around like this, you know, kind of, you know, Batman 1989 Tim Burton mode, you know,
with the stiff, around. Locked neck, yeah.
And I'm in a room that's, I guess it's based on Portal. It's called Aperture. And so I'm in this bay.
Aperture? Aperture. Yeah, Aperture Sciences. Yeah. No, this, it's adorable. It's adorable.
No, this is amazing. Because I don't even know what Andrew's about to say, but I know specifically for Jason and Brian, it's just like, so anyway, I went to this place, Disneyland. I think it had something about tomorrow.
I saw Bugs Bunny there. Bugs Bunny was.
So you're in
the lab.
Yeah.
After labs.
You're in the lab. You have these controllers, which then come up. They then become these sort of grips. And his voice is, all right, step over to this wall and pull out these trays. Like, I look over and there's, I'm reaching my arms out. I can't reach it. So I'm like, oh, maybe I need to walk over. So I walk over to the wall and my wall is now next to the wall. I take my little pincers and I grab the tray, slide it open.
Now, okay, so first of all, this is a no-no in Oculus land. You don't physically get up and walk anywhere. All the Oculus stuff we've seen have been like, put yourself in a thing where you can pretend to walk forward or use keyboard or mouse or whatever. You physically walked in this space and encountered an actual wall at the right spot.
Interacted with it in a way that, like, he physically was brought to a point and then interacted with it, which is something.
I pull out this tray and I look down as people go running around and I'm like, oh, this is cool. This would make a great game one day, right? Shut the drawer and it says go over to the other bay door and pull the handle. So I go over there and you're using these controllers. We're kind of like Wii One sort of clicker things. And in the virtual space, you see like these robot hands. I go over there, grab a handle, and again, physically walk over to the space. I'm not like, oh, let me hit the right button on my keyboard or go over there. I'm like, no, I just effing walk over there, reach over, pull the handle down. All of a sudden, the door goes, and there's a robot that needs to be serviced. Comes into the room, and I back up to make room for the robot, undo the panel. Next thing you know, they start playing the manual, like, oh, be sure to fix the 2-to-1 or 2-0, but don't forget to do this. And so it's kind of a joke because it's, you know, the humor of the game.
Right.
So the next thing you know, you're trying to operate on things and doing mechanically, like, fix and tweak things. And so – and I stepped back because this robot was, like, filling – and I had to, like, tell myself, no, you can walk through that space. It's okay. It's not real. So that was that experience, okay. And, this would be the demo, I think, that we're playing here.
Yeah, our fabulous producer, Neshcom. And for those of you who are gamers, it looks like it's Atlas and Peabody from Portal 2.
Oh, my God.
What you're seeing there, I'm there. I was there watching this, and you're looking all the way around. What's great about the Vive is its refresh rate is 90 frames per second, right?
Oh, tasty.
There was no latency. I can't go on Star Tours because I get motion sickness. Before this, me and some people were talking about, like, well, how long will you be able to sit in a VR experience? What's the length of time on that? Whatever. When I went into this and I talked to my buddy who I went there with afterwards, like, we could have done this for hours. So, yeah, I did the same thing right now. You're seeing this handle grab this lever and pull it down. And this is – it's photorealistic.
Oh, my gosh.
No, this – I literally thought this when we started playing this, that this was just footage from a garage, like, it just in that first shot, because the lighting, like, was just so amazing. Like it looked so good. It kind of looked dingy. You're just taking cell phone videos
like something
initially before the magic happens.
My buddy I brought with me, Ken Gust, he's with Synaptics Effects. One of his partners – Sean was a guy that worked on Troops, the Stormtrooper, you know, short that started all that stuff. So his big VFX guy, I told Ken, I'm like, do this demo first because it's photorealistic. If you told me, hey, we're going to put some goggles on your head and we're going to put some high quality video cameras in front and we're just going to feed you a tap of what's right in front of you.
Yeah.
That's what it felt like. It felt like it was a real place. It was not, oh, it's like a wraparound monitor. I'm looking at. It was a real place. The next demo, I'm on the deck of a sunken ship, right?
Uh-huh.
And I'm watching manta rays glide around me, blue whales go by, and the only thing missing was I wanted to feel like water or waves or whatever on me, but it was intense. I mean, it's just a thing. Ken's friend, his girlfriend Patricia, she'd gone swimming with manta rays, and she came out of that like, oh my God, that just took me back to a magical time and place when I did that, you know. And you can go to the edge of the bow of the ship and look over and you get vertigo because all of a sudden you just see
down
this drop way below you, right?
So in terms of the spatial element, like it takes an inventory of the room that you're in and then just gives you subtle cues when you're too far, but like does it shape the world to fit the room?
So I don't know. I think with the first demo, the portal type demo, I think that it could adjust the size of the room to where you are. And I found myself, I had a lot more room to walk in than I did. And we're upstairs in a sweaty loft. And and it can do that. I did a demo at the MXR lab at USC last year where it would shape, you would walk into a room and then you'd go to leave. They would move the door when you're looking away behind you so you could exit. So you were able to go through an entire Afghani village searching for weapons inside.
And
it would just keep
shaping, sort of like when you play Call of Duty, they call that kind of game on rails because, you know, you feel like you're choosing to go left or right, but really it's just tunneling you down a corridor. Right. But you would choose that in real time.
Yeah, with this, what they're going to be able to do, like, you know, if, you know, people, some people like who haven't done, like, yeah, but what if I can't keep running? Like, no, you know, you can't keep running, but you might be able to get to a spot and then jog in place and then get to another spot and then do combat or whatever in free space and not you'll, it's a, you know, treadmills and stuff like that, maybe, but this was incredible. So the next thing I did after that, everything goes dark. And then I'm in a room that feels like a real darkened room,
Which by the way, I would imagine that they're pretty good at simulating since you're wearing goggles over your eyeballs.
But I could see things. I could see walls. I could see stuff like that.
It would be just like dark.
If you stepped into a room where there's like a nightlight. One hand has this color wheel. The other hand, the wand is glowing. It's a glowing paintbrush that glows, that makes this glow paint in midair. So when I press, if I touch blue and I go like make a line across there, I make a blue line.
And this
now
is,
I step to the side, it's in completely in 3D. So I started drawing like letters in space and then walked around them. I could draw clouds. I could draw raindrops in three-dimensional space, then walk through the raindrops.
So, okay. And what I love most about this is that it sounds to me, if I'm hearing you describe it correctly, or if I'm hearing you correctly, like the objects that you're holding are the same shape and size as the objects as you perceive them, right?
Relative. They make them feel consistent. But the incredible thing is like, so imagine you're painting in three-dimensional space and you can walk through it, interact with it. It's sick. It was just incredible. So once I got stepped out of this thing, my experience was this is something, it's not just something I would buy to develop for, to experiment with. This is something I would buy to play with and to have fun with. Like, you know, a game like Arkham Knights looks cool to me, but to play Arkham Knights in a system like this where you're going to stand there and look around and actually be in Gotham, holy crap. I mean, it was as profound as an experience as like the first time I ever – and now what you're watching a demo right now. We're watching a guy paint in black and white. What I did was far more advanced than this. It was colors, multiple colors. You could see his physical sense of the space in the room around you. I could make like a field of grass that you could walk through in real time.
Wow.
And you look at that and you think of how even simple things like Minecraft became a juggernaut because it said, you know what, PCs are fast enough that we can now, you know, create these realistic 3D environments, you know, good enough 3D environments that you can interact and shape and control.
Right.
In VR, it's going to get sick.
It changes everything, really. I mean, it's not just gaming. This is a lot of people don't get it unless they've experienced it. Most people that I'm talking to, they really don't understand that, okay, everybody just thinks, oh, it's the Virtual Boy. It's Lawnmower Man, you know?
Yeah.
That's what everybody thinks. But no, this is punctuated evolution in technology.
This really will become this is as important as when we saw, you know, I don't know who gets credit for it, but you know, the desktop interface that we associate with the Mac. I mean, this will become the preferred environment to design and develop as brains, you know, and again, we're all too old. We're going to be dead, dumb corpses by the time that this becomes the de facto standard. Meanwhile, like my children are going to grow up expecting that this is the way that it's like, God, why are we typing with keyboards? It's so dumb. Why are we drawing with mouses, with mice? It's so dumb.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's going to be part of the experience. I think it certainly is going to be part of it. And when I was in there, I'm thinking, you know, I wanted to check my Apple Watch to look at the time, and I'm like, man, you know, we're not – I don't think you're going to want to re-engineer Facebook so everybody can go into 3D to do Facebook, but you're going to want to have a version of Facebook that works when you're in that world.
Well, it's – to me, it's the difference between getting grown-up business done on my phone versus my desktop. For example, Jason and I – just spent 2.5 hours working on this pitch for a thing, and he physically came over to my house because we knew that for the two of us, it was going to be better for us to sit there and actually, you know, Photoshop this, type this out, you know, talk back and forth or whatever. The desktop is the superior platform for creative endeavors right now, but for some creative endeavors, nothing will compare to this again.
When we can all hop into there and we can all of a sudden explore shared spaces, you know, I like the room where you paint with. I said, man, if we had like Minecraft Legos in there and we, you know, the four of us could jump inside of there and start building like we did when we were kids, but bigger ones, and make machines to go to war with each other.
Right. Well, and,
invite everybody in Diamond Realm to show up on a virtual field. And that. I went to bed that night thinking about the fact that every one of those spaces I went to felt like a real space. It felt like a real place. And the idea that when we think about what Snow Crash talked about and the concept of what happens when these virtual places just aren't these siloed different degrees of interactions with just a computer program, but when they feel like real physical spaces and you know, do we start saying, you know, does Warcraft become a planet?
Well,
you know, does it really, and not just separate servers, but no, we'll have separate continents or whatever here, but this is a planet and we start connecting these spaces together. It just gets insane.
So here's the biggest thing that is just kind of becoming clear to me is we right now have a moment in popular culture for like conventions, right? We're all going to be at Dragon Con. We very much love the idea of a suspended universe where a lot of these things are real, you know, like Renaissance fairs are a similar idea. Like if this is the mainstream, moment for the idea that like, this isn't just a special place that you have to travel for, you can live in these worlds without the like, yeah, you know, it's cool, but sort of hangover of where even advanced VR now tends to be. That's gigantic.
Well, what I found is that it's so easy to trick your brain that the photorealistic graphics that you were talking about in the Portal simulation, that's great, but in my experience with the Oculus Rift, wholly unnecessary. It's amazing and I'd love to see it, but everything that I've experienced, it was like a low res, almost like a 16-bit or maybe like an N64 era replication of walking around the Millennium Falcon. Yeah. And it was wholly immersive, and when things shifted, I would, you know, steady myself. And so like the graphical fidelity was
less really important to you than just the immersiveness, yes, of the head tracking and stuff. Yeah.
To your point, just, I think there, you, once you click a certain couple of things, the experience becomes really cool, but there is that difference between, you know, for me, it was, I didn't feel like I was sticking my, like at the edge of the pool, sticking my head underwater, looking under the water and seeing the fish. I felt like I was in the pool. I hate metaphors, but the connection between me and the space evaporated. Not that I was just felt like I was dipping into it, but it just evaporated where I was in that space.
So here, let's, as we tend to do on Weird Things, let's project kind of what the consequences of this kind of technology are in the future.
It occurs, total loss of productivity.
I would say total gain of productivity, but no. Imagine this. Imagine a world where when you buy a house, just like when, you know, for our entire lifetimes, sort of your ability to, if you had disposable income, you would, and you were buying a TV, you would, all things being equal, you would buy the biggest display you're able to afford for the highest fidelity experience, right? Right. So imagine a world when you buy spaces or when you rent apartments. One of the things nowadays, the big thing is bandwidth. You know, it's like you will pick an apartment because they offer gigabit versus only, you know, 10 megabit, whatever crap. I can imagine a world where it's like, oh, and this one has a holotarium of over 75 by 75 feet wide. So you get a very high fidelity experience. And then, you know, if you need to, you will, you know, there will be giant shared spaces that you could run entire football fields at a time.
Well, in that respect, that's kind of a step backwards, though, right? I mean, especially as space becomes at a premium, like in, you know, Tokyo, for instance. Aren't we looking at, wouldn't the ideal manifestation of this be where you no space at all is required?
Well, theoretically.
You know, we can, Yeah, but I mean, you know, before we get to there, there's a lot of here. There's a lot of distance between here and there, and you know, there will be no final form of it. And I think that what we're going to see, like the product I saw, they said they're going to try to have shipping end of year, right? They want to have end of year, you'll be able to buy this thing and do this thing.
Christmas this year.
Yeah, this year. And it may slip to early next year, but their goal is to have it where on the shelves, you can go buy this thing this year, which the first thing that's going to happen is we're going to get rid of our goddamn coffee tables.
Dude, we're going to need room to run around. And you're right. The living room is the obvious choice for everyone to install these. All of a sudden, people are going to figure out a lot of places they can wedge those couches.
Murphy beds are going to become popular.
Yeah. Now's the time to leverage that name.
Yes. The empire of collapsible beds.
Approved Murphy beds.
Exactly.
It's hard. I mean, we can think in a lot of ways. I can think that, you know, from a personal point of view, the kind of interactions I had, now that we're watching video of this paint thing, which is nowhere near as exciting as what this looks all wireframe. What I saw was full color in a room. It's like we said, let's dim the lights a bit and paint in the middle of space with glowing wands. I'm excited about the idea of, you know, somebody's going to build a virtual Disneyland. And what is a virtual Disneyland going to be? You know, we can Pirates of the Caribbean. It doesn't have to be. And again, gaming, I'm not a big gamer, so I try to look at it from a different kind of context.
Sure. But it's about storytelling and situations. Now, in fact, just the other night, I got into a discussion with someone. You know, we were talking about environmentalism, but it's like, I mean, do you think in the future that we're going to bother to build physical Disneylands? Yes. Eventually you will have the amount of resources that go into all of Disney World, all of the worlds around it. That level of human effort will go into a completely virtual theme park.
But it won't eliminate the other, though. Escalators have an obviated stairs.
But and that is correct. But what I'm saying is like we can now have a rich, rich experience with literally or virtually zero environmental impact whatsoever. You don't even need to build the things.
We will have awesome experiences there, but we still going to see live sports is still a $1 billion thing, even though what you watch at home is a much better experience.
Sure. Well, those will be the expensive seats. Those will be the premium seats. Those will be the thing that the super rich get to brag. Well, it's like, yeah, but I was actually there. Meanwhile, the hoi polloi will all be able to spend $5 and get a front row center court seat at the NBA finals, you know?
Well, extrapolating it, will we be getting rid of most of the things that we see around us, like, you know, the art hanging in our rooms? Well, we just have, okay, you know what? I don't need anything but something to keep my food cold and my a shower and like basically a box. I just need a big box.
And to your point, Jason, you know, one of the things I talk to some of my friends who employ like younger people, like 20-year-olds or whatever, they talk about how when somebody has their Netflix account, their HBO account, and their online access in their phone, they don't have the same concept of materialism that a generation did before them. And so, yeah.
Here's my question for you, Andrew. If this is going to go on sale in December, is this a possible, like, on the scale of zero to Nintendo Wii when it first came out, being kind of this, it was away from where the trend of console gaming was going, which was, you know, more speed, more power, and was instead relying on a whole new way of interacting with games. Is this something that could make a mainstream impact?
You know, I think yes. The answer to that is going to be that it's Oculus is going to price itself to try to get as many hands as possible. So everybody already has a fast gaming rig. Oculus will be attractive. Vive will be more expensive, but I think that there's going to be the debate, you know, which do you want? If you just want to sit in a chair and, you know, you're a keyboard type gamer, getting up and doing those kind of experiences won't be the same for you. There's going to be different things, but I think both of them are going to have a profound impact on how people interact. I think Vive is exciting because if the only time you use a keyboard is to write email and enter in search engines, and the rest of the time you want to kind of just be in three-dimensional meat space, The Vive is going to be exciting. I think we're going to start looking at non-gaming stuff, but it's going to be the one that I think many lay people will put on and go, holy cow, I get this now. And I kind of get why gamers get what they get out of a game.
Well, the key is getting it into people's hands. I've talked to so many people, mostly gamers, who don't get it. Even if I'm explaining to them, no, it's amazing. They still are thinking, like I said earlier, Virtual Boy or you know, Lawnmower Man or the stuff you experience at the mall. And it's hard to really sell it to someone without them experiencing one of the models.
Exactly. And, you know, then I saw like on Verge or whatever, they talked about demoing the Vive, and you would see some people like, nope, Oculus for me. I don't need, you know, who needs to view this the room or whatever. It's like, great. But just try.
It's so amazing to me. Here's the thing: is this not even out? I know. But this is the console wars mentality, right? This is, and it all goes down to we're all still 7 years old. Everyone who participates in a console war is still a 7 year old who knows he can only ask Santa for either an Xbox or a PlayStation, and he has to choose. And then once you choose, you have to fight really hard because the worst thing you could possibly acknowledge is that you made the wrong choice to Santa that one time.
There's going to be, like, I love going to planetariums. Planetariums, I think, are one of these underappreciated forms of media that we have, because you go in there, you sit down, we recreate the entire universe on this dome, and a really good planetarium show can be a transcendent experience. You start thinking about creating those kinds of experiences for something like Vive or Oculus or whatever, and you put this on somebody like, oh, hey, guess what? We got virtual Carl Sagan to explain the universe to you. In person. Takes you on a cosmic odyssey.
Yeah. Well, and again, that's the down the road stuff. Like right now, it's almost a bit of a crime that the way this begins is with, you know, visceral entertainment. You know, it's like what this will mean down the road to have. Imagine if we were able to start recording back in the day, and nowadays you could take a class by actual Leonardo da Vinci in his actual studio, actually walking you through everything. I mean, it's this is where you keep thinking like, oh, history began at blank. And it's like, there are those who will say history really begins with Fidelity, you know, this year.
The demo we see right now, that's like what I saw. That was what I was doing, where I was painting in three-dimensional space with glowing lines like that.
It's significantly improved from the other demo that we saw.
And the experience, too, is like we're watching the sort of the kind of the virtual camera move around. But when it's you motivating the movement, when you're just leaning, it's like when you watch somebody else, you put a camera on, put a GoPro on somebody else's head and they move around.
Yeah.
You're like, okay. But when it's you moving in and doing and motivating the movement, it's real.
Well, that,
it's
amazing. And that's, I remember realizing, you know, about 10 years ago, I was playing Oblivion and I was just, you know, marveling at how good the sunsets looked and how, you know, rich the environments were. And I realized that, you know, I was like, well, to my wife, you know, she is blind in one eye. So she experiences all of 3D is 3D to her thanks to the motion of parallax, right? Which is that linking of you initiate a movement and then the relative motion between everything, clouds move at a different speed than the tree right next to you and so on. I would imagine that especially at that high refresh, that having that sense of creating parallax is just as important, if not more, than having two eyes and stereoscopic vision.
Oh, yeah. It just, you know, sometimes people who have like only sight in one eye, they'll do the thing where they tilt their head back and forth, you know, they do that little thing to create the simulation. And in this would work. All those things, all those cues are there. Just the subtle movement of your head back and forth, adjusting it. It's so anyhow, to sum up,
Sorry. I really apologize. And I want your opinion on this, Andrew, because watching that demo, the art demo, it's like immediate. I just want to, for everybody who is just listening to this, like you need to, we need to maybe throw the link in the show notes or whatever, but like I could see, you know, you put just a baseline kind of rule element, like this is the building element of Minecraft, like an art world where you can make literally whatever you want, and then your friends can walk through it and stuff like that, or you can build it together. It is mind blowing. This is fantastic.
Now, speaking, this is going to sound stereotypically me, and I'm seriously not doing that, but much like with Blu-rays and DVDs and the internet, is the success of one of these virtual realities or just the whole platform going to be buttressed by pornography.
Oh, in the hugest way. And in fact, there's some funny videos where I believe they collected a bunch of rap stars. They put Oculus Rift on them, and then they showed them 360 degree visual porn, and it's all point of view stuff. And you know, these are people who know that there are cameras on them.
Yeah.
Who are just like one of them at one point says, "Well, I deeply regret wearing sweatpants right now."
Well, when you put on when you're able to put on a pair of goggles,
sure.
and hold some sticks and have sex with Scarlett Johansson, it's gonna make heroin look like Diet Coke.
So hypothetically, I may know somebody who's tried some of those VR porn experiences, and they are very intense. But there has been an overstatement of like a technology catches on when porn gets into it, because everything, you know, every porn tries to get onto everything, every form of technology, DivX, the original DivX, all that stuff.
Oh my gosh!
And
yeah.
So it can often be this. Porn's tried to support a lot of things that could never work. We will, as long as we've had charcoal and cave walls, we've been creating porn.
Yeah.
But there's not an invention that we have not tried to bang. Does it work? Great. Can I have sex with it?
The success of the technology isn't if we can put porn onto it, because there are many, many crush technologies that people try.
But will it support the technology until the mainstream catches on?
I wouldn't count on that.
I think that's
vice versa.
Yeah, it's got to be mainstream, and then porn can make it more.
But there's already a lawsuits flying from a teledildonics company suing other ones for claiming.
I know, I saw that.
Is it really?
Yeah, there's a patent. We got a patent war.
I had a friend who I've been talking some of these projects with. He says, you know, I ran into Rocco Siffredi at a store, and I was thinking, if we wanted to, we could talk to him about it. I'm like, it's not an area I want to get into.
Man, LA is a fun town.
Hey,
I was at a party Friday night with a kangaroo.
Dang it, talk about burying the lead. You tell us your story about going to Silicon Beach, and then you get around to mentioning you partied with a kangaroo. Are you kidding?
It was a Back to the Future party on a castle overlooking the Hollywood Hills, overlooking Los Angeles, and I get there at crazy LA type thing, and my buddy goes, "Oh yeah, did you even see the kangaroo?" I'm like, "Ha ha, kangaroo." I'm walking down some steps. I see a fence, and I see an emu running by.
What?
Like, oh, okay. And I look over, and they're in the corner. They say it's a Joey or whatever. But like a little kangaroo is kind of cowering in the corner, just like, are they gone yet?
Holy cow! Are you able to share the details of why that was, or was that part of the mystique of the party?
The kangaroo was their pet.
You know what's funny is when you said a castle overlooking Hollywood Hills, I thought that you were talking about the Magic Castle. I was like, they must have had some event.
This is a different castle. There was an actual DeLorean set up like Back to the Future there. Crazy. Everybody was like Back to the Future attire. I wore two ties and in my pockets inside out.
Oh, that's amazing.
Folks, you too can support Andrew Main's Caligula-esque extravagant LA lifestyle by going to patreon.com/weirdthings. That is where we support the show. If you head on over there right now, you will understand that you could be part of an army of 463 patrons kicking in money that helps us pay for Bryce Neshcom Castillo to make sure that we are having a show every week and we know what the hell we're talking about and we're gathering up emails and stuff like that. So go ahead and check us out. That is patreon.com/weirdthings.
Oh, yeah. So, hey, I had something that I wanted to chit-chat with you guys about. I don't know if either of you guys listened to it, but lately I've been on a binge. Actually, thanks to your co-host on Rage Select, Jeff got me listening to the Cracked.com podcast.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
And the guy who writes is David Wong, Jason Parjan, I think his name is. There was an episode, I'm getting caught up from like 4 months ago or whatever, and they're talking about artificial racial constructs and sexism constructs. And the reason that we need to get rid of them is not so much because you owe a debt or it's somehow your fault that your great, 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 great grandfather owned slaves or whatever, but because, you know, that we, where you are now is a side effect of where you came from. And basically it portrayed everyone as a leaf on a tree, right? It said, you are a leaf on a tree and you are the result of everything that happened before you. So, it's not a tree's fault that it ran into, you know, this one place, but it is the tree's responsibility to correct its growth or whatever. Sure. Right. And at some point offhandedly to explain it, they said, like, look how racist ants are. And by which they meant the moment an ant encounters another ant.
Aunt says horrible stuff about my niece all the time.
And they say the ants in general.
My aunt is a huge Hulk Hogan fan.
And they said at some point offhandedly, ants are very racist if they encounter a slightly different ant, by which I assume let's mean an ant of another species, they will immediately attack it and they'll go to war and they'll fight and they'll slay the other one, right? He says if all the ants were to get on the same team and take out humanity, we would absolutely lose.
I've seen that movie.
Okay, well, and exactly, right? But it got me thinking, like, you hear that, you're
so
like...
Fast.
The first thing you think of is then they put out the statistics that there is literally for every human. I want to ask you guys, for every human on Earth, how many ants do you think there are, Jason? Realistic answer. Your true answer. Yeah, yeah.
I'm gonna go for every human.
For every human. For you personally.
For me, I'm gonna say I'm gonna go high. I'm gonna go 5 million.
All right, Justin.
I'm gonna go. 4.99 million.
What is this, Price is Right?
It's reverse. It's the worst version of Price is Right ever. Andrew?
100,000.
It is 10 million ants for every living human on the planet, right? So here's this got me thinking, like, okay, realistically, let's say right now a lightning bolt strikes, all ants become agreed. They're not brilliant. They're not smart. They're not much smarter than they are right now. The one thing they agree on is that we're all on the same team and that we have one goal to universally wipe out humanity, right? So they can't do anything they couldn't do now. Number one, how much of mankind gets wiped out and do the ants ultimately win in general, full stop? Now, again, we're looking at I'm sure someone in the chat could give us the total number of ants on the entire planet, because here's what got me thinking about it is there are two things. Number one, let's say they immediately start attacking. And I would imagine that if their goal was to kill humans, that most rural areas would immediately become ant seeded. They would have control of all rural areas. Yeah. But now they're able to reproduce and use 100% of all the land, so their numbers become even higher.
Exponentially.
And then, and so I'm thinking, like, in my mind, I'm thinking, like, well, first of all, tell me where your guys' minds are at. What are the first things that happen?
I'm just thinking is why the FBI keeps asking me why I'm making napalm in my garage all the time. It's for this.
Justin?
So we've locked down the scenario. We know where we're playing inside. The question is, how bad would a united ant invasion front be?
How bad would it be? Would they possibly full on win? Or does our intellect allow us to win? And if so, in what practical measures can we take? And I'm sure Andrew already has plans that he's formulating about nuking stuff from space, just to be sure. But in the short term, I would imagine, yes, it's every ant disaster movie we've seen. It's Kingdom of the Spiders. It's all that stuff. Only I would imagine with a lot more losses. And once the losses happen, I would imagine they would become total just because they have the numbers. You know, once the small town of Round Rock, Texas falls, I don't see a couple of lone survivors hanging in there.
Well, I don't even know if it'll get that bad. I mean, what kind of warning do we have? I mean, that's the big
zero
one, right?
Warning. Like one day they all they quietly have all decided.
If it just immediately starts happening, we could be screwed.
Well, right. Okay.
Well, all right. So let's try to wrap our head around conceptually what this looks like. Effectively, it's just a wave, a rising tide of ants that if you get near, will consume, right? Or it will consume as high as that tide is, and we are assuming that it is growing. That like an ant-controlled small Texas town would be a town that literally has ants all over it. Like that is consumed by ants, right? Because it's not like they're like picking off the people because they know that like those are strategic assets to you know, for their survival and winning of the war. This is a brute strength invasion.
Yes. Like all the ants know is ants are bros and humans need to be eaten, right? And so I don't know, Andrew, where's your head at on this?
I'm already writing this in my head for the novel. There was a book, Saul Bass, the legendary designer, AT&T logo, all these, you know, these graphic, one of the most famous ever. He directed one movie.
Yep.
Phase Four, all about this. And in answer to your question, I think that the one thing we have helping us is ants don't do well in really cold weather climates.
Okay.
So if they attack us in mass at once, you know, yeah, we could be screwed. You know, we start, you know, red ants start biting us and killing us and then going after us, eating our food. But there will be pockets of humanity in places where there are no ants. And I got to think our ant pesticide development is going to increase dramatically. And we're going to try to say, like, screw them.
We will kill these pastures. Will the collateral damage, though.
Oh! Environmental damage, tremendous.
So talk us through this. Give us the Andrew Main novel. Give us the arcs. Right. Like what cities fall?
So here's opening scene. President's killed by ants. Also the vice president. Also the entire line of people that would take over for president. And in a bizarre bylaw of the Constitution, it says the person who just released Name of the Devil, available now at Amazon, you know, becomes president. Andrew Main ascends to the highest position of power. How do you repel this ant attack?
By the way, of course, reporting for duty is your cabinet, Brian, Justin, and why?
How long have we known each other?
We're all going to die.
God damn it.
We're all going to die. I'm going to throw my body onto an anthill right now and, so here's what happens. You have this sort of thing happen. You know, this thing takes place. Let's say it's just like red ants, whatever, that's all around you. They just get extremely predatory. They start seeking people out, killing them. They still need food. They still have to move in mass from place to place to do this. What I would do, I mean, number one, what's going to happen is what are going to be the places that are going to be safe already? Our Navy, for the most part. You know, there might be ants on board, whatever, but there's going to be, hey, kill all the ants, protect your food, whatever. All of our ships at sea going to be safe for a while, okay? Certain military facilities, some of our biolabs, things like that are going to be functioning. We identify right now that it's ants, and we start thinking, where is it really cold? Where are these colder climates where we're not getting
ants? Before we get there, how bad, how many lives, what percentage of American lives right now on we'll just say the continental United States, or we'll just say American lives, full stop, what percentage are lost? How bad is this attack?
I think, I would have to try to figure out, you know, how many red ants are around you that could kill you? You know, how many ants are around you that are capable of killing you? What's the loss of life in the first hour, the first 24 hours? What's the loss of life in the next 7 days?
And how many stings does it take to kill a healthy human adult? Well,
Brian, you got a backyard.
You know, I mean,
why don't we guys do an experiment?
Oh, jeez. I'll go roll around. I'm like, hey, guys.
And this is, by the way, using ants for malicious purposes is a side plot line in my new book I just turned into my agent.
Oh, that's awesome. Nice. Tom Adana says from the chat, this is unverified until we see a source on it, but he says 1,000 bites from any ants will kill you, whether or not they're poisonous.
This was the same person in the chat room who said that his plan was we all gather in one area and build a giant magnifying glass to fry the ants.
Well, okay, first of all, that's a legit plan, and Mr. President, I'd like to suggest we build a giant magnifying glass immediately.
I, for one, welcome our new ant overlords.
I think that you know, we're going to start, you know, I think there could be a lot. We have to, I mean, I don't know. I have no clue to tell you how deadly would it be if they all tried to kill us. Word would get around fast. Hey, listen, ants are killing people. Something's got driving them berserk. Stay away from ants. You know, figure out how you can kill them. You know, what are you going to do to spread around your floor to do that? And we go to war, you know?
Yeah, I mean, effectively, it becomes chemical and sonic warfare. Right. Like, I mean, like, I feel like that's what we do immediately is we start, you know, just like finding out in your household what can be the most effective mass ant killer. We become a lot more lax on inhaling poisons, and we just start, you know, throwing any and everything that we can.
And our war against the ants leads to complete colony collapse.
There we go. They were like, hey, man, how are we killing those bees? Let's double down on all that, people.
Yeah.
Well, you know, got to read Matt Ridley's observations on the bee thing, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's, it's not as perhaps dire as people make it out to be, and the neo-Nick stuff is probably based on faulty research, and one of the biggest things contributing to that is how beekeepers will travel their bees tremendous distances, which fatigue them and then expose them to fungus that they're not used to. And
interesting.
It's more complicated than we'd like, and it's not to say, hey, everything's fine, but Matt Ridley, rationaloptimist.com, type in colony collapse. And
I want to read World War A. As written by Andrew Main. Because that's what this sounds like.
Funny, you know? Is like yesterday I was thinking about, like, I love, like, those stories, like, you know, Planet of the Apes, apes go crazy. Jurassic Park, apes go crazy. Patterson has zoo, you know, animal. I'm like, and then zombies. I'm like, man, I want to write something where there's something eating us or killing us. And I'm in my head as you're talking about this, I'm like, how do I make ants interesting? I'm thinking, like, you know what I could do too is like the ants that like drive people, like animals, crazy or something too. Is that like, you know,
oh yeah, yeah, the ones that like infect with, or I mean, an ant with some kind of, I don't know, hallucinogenic compound that allowed them to, you know, enough of them sting that it causes them, similar to The Last of Us,
yeah,
you know,
cordyceps
with fungus, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so if I'm hearing the consensus seems to be between the four of us. That I'm going to go out and say a good 2/3 of humanity. I say it's a pretty big hit. Even if we have good intellectual hygiene and we get the word out fast and everyone uses their pesticides, I'd say we lose everything north or everything between the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn.
Yeah,
I think that belongs to the ants for a while. I think that we retreat to frozen areas. Really?
I like how you're ready to give it up for the ants.
Oh, no, I'm just going to say they win full stop. I mean, it's, I don't see how you're going to stop them. They got the numbers. 10 million to one? How many
can I stomp if I start playing, you know, some Michael Flatley river dance music?
Not 10 million.
Do you think you could ever kill 10 million?
In your lifetime? Ever. Do you think you could kill 10? Can really?
They're tiny.
No. Okay. Okay.
Beyond brute force. I mean, again, we have gigantic crop dusters that we can just be, you know, dropping whatever.
How many do you think you kill and what? How many, if they're all coalescing on a carpet below you, and how many do you think you could stomp on if they're on your tile floor, if they're all gathered together in mass?
I would say of 10 million, I would say 0.00001.
How many do you think under footprint, under one footfall, how many do you think would crush if you stomped down on them?
Well, given when ants are... I don't know how on top of each other are they? Because normally they spread out. I would say
one ant layer, just one ant deep. How many are you going to fit into an average male footprint size?
I don't know, maybe 700 tops if you're lucky.
Let's call it 1,000.
Fine, let's call it 1,000, which means it'll only take 1,000 stomps without getting bit or injured or stopped.
Oh, you can get bit.
Somebody,
you're going to get bit.
Look up the amount of steps in a Michael Flatley river dance.
Michael Flatley is your protagonist, Andrew.
Yeah, finally, the Irish hero.
So you take, if I take 500 strides, I've killed a million.
No, but they've already killed you. You're insane. Okay, look, weight of ant. Oh, doggone it. Or mass of ant? Mass?
There's also
using Wolfram Alpha.
Yeah. There's also how insidious it is, because there are so many times when I've been standing in someone's yard and suddenly, oh, I've been in a fire ant bed for the last 3 minutes.
So somebody in the chat room, give me the mass of the average ant times 10,000, because like the biomass of all ants is much, much more than, I mean, you're looking at a foe for each individual player. Now that doesn't even factor in every time the ants take out a human. They now it's 20 million to one on the next guy.
Oh yeah.
It's like, then they just keep rolling. But you're telling me you're going to step
on
them?
There's no way we're ceding land to ants. We will light the rivers aflame.
It's disgusting.
With chemicals before we seed something to ants.
I think third world.
I'm getting in my truck. I don't have my imaginary truck. I'm like getting a steamroller. I'm wrapping. I'll tape myself up. Assuming they don't get me right. As soon as you give me the call, like right now, ants are going crazy. I'm grabbing everybody in the house. We're wrapping ourselves in plastic wrap, you know.
Well, think about third world countries.
Like, let's just start stomping these things.
Third world countries are going to be completely obliterated.
Hey, that's what I'm saying. When I say we lose everything north to south, yeah, agreed. That's exactly what I'm saying. By the way,
stop this, man.
In mass, it looks like 10 million ants is about 0.71 typical standard human adult masses. So almost the size of your body you're up against.
That's true. Yeah, that's a number I'd heard. But also understand, like, how many are in this? That's worldwide. How many are in this neighborhood?
Okay, that is true. But again, that's why I'm saying I bet there's a lot more. I mean, Brazil, you think Brazil's going to just stomp their way out of that?
No,
rainforest comes.
No,
leaf cutter ants, man.
No, Brian, I'm not saying that everybody survived. I'm not saying that – you're saying everybody's gone between here and there.
I understand. You and I are on the same team as far as believing that eventually humans will win.
I don't know whose team you're on.
We both agree that humans will end. I think that there would be a lot more losses, especially if it was a Pearl Harbor surprise attack. I think.
What about the Orkin factory?
I think that those 800 people will definitely live while the city of 8 million around them falls.
And then they're gonna march triumphantly forward with their spray tanks
and try to save people. Again, the question at hand is how bad are the losses before we rebound?
Catastrophic, Brian.
Yeah, I know. So give me a number.
Are you happy now?
Yeah, no, I want you to guess. That's the whole point of this game.
Wait, hold on. The whole point of this was he wanted to guess a death toll?
Yes, that's exactly. Like, how good a strike,
Brian,
will they get in before they go down?
I promise you this. More ants will die than humans.
What? By the numbers.
So we'll win. Okay.
USA! USA!
Yeah, I just don't know where to put a 40,000, a million, I don't know. In the fake ant attack, like, I don't know. I suspect that we are thinking of the most devastating version of it, and should this become a massive issue that we would have possibly over the top long term harmful solutions that we would deploy because we are scared and angry people.
All right, we need to let's go into picks and change the topic radically away from where we're headed with that. Anybody see any movies they want to talk about?
Man, you know what? This was a crazy week.
Did we all see Ant-Man?
Oh, geez. I can't wait. That happened since last time we did the show, didn't we? Wow. Yeah, you saw Ant-Man too, right?
No, I never go to the movies.
Do you care if we spoil it for you?
I know already a lot about it. With the Marvel movies, I mean, you know how many Marvel comics I read? I watch it and I'm like, well, of course that happened because that's what happened. So go ahead.
Okay, right on. You won't believe it. An unlikely charismatic hero is placed in a situation where he has to take on a villain. What did you guys think?
I liked it. I liked the Ant-Man. It's kind of very interesting because the idea of Ant-Man, I think, very much filled what my expectations were for it. Ant-Man to me is kind of a peripheral character. I think Paul Rudd was great in the role, but a fun little it takes one big detour out of self-contained during the movie, but by and large, this is about three people that are trying to hoodwink one person. The global ramifications are kind of hinted at compared to most Marvel movies, where it's like, if this man hits this button, the world will split in half. And it was great. It certainly felt like a script that characteristically un-Marvel-like seemed to be a bit disjointed, and it doesn't quite know whether or not it's a Paul Rudd movie or a Michael Douglas movie in terms of where you're focusing on the main character for the first two acts. But the third act, once we get into the heist, I thought was super fun. It had really like some of the more inspired sort of beats for that kind of Marvel visual language stuff that almost, I read a review that made a point that it almost felt Pixar-esque in terms of how they were, especially in the visual beats in the third act. There's just a lot of, like, not a lot of wasted moments. Like, somebody looks to the left and there's, like, just a really funny sight gag, and those kind of permeate them. So I dug it. I thought it was rad.
Man, I felt it was, I felt like there was an, oftentimes there'll be movies where you have a fun enough process and you realize the entire time you've been watching an install screen and the bar got to like 66%. And then all of a sudden it's like a rubber band snaps and everything starts going fast. You're like, oh, wait, that's why we had the thing so that we could see the, oh, and that's why we learned about the so-and-so. So he would, and this one, I felt like, for example, during his training phase, it's like, you got to jump through this keyhole to practice. And I was like, oh, this is going to be great. This is going to be like a video game movie where it's like, we're going to learn a bunch of his skills. We're going to see him use. And then it's going to be an orgasmic display of all of them coming together. And instead, we only saw him jump through the keyhole and then we saw him jump through a bullet hole later. And then it's like, you've got to think like an ant to make the ants think or whatever. And it's like, oh, this is going to be a animal companion movie. We're going to learn to fall in love with his favorite ant, Flyboy, and give names to them all. And instead, it's just one ant. And then, you know, if and when that one dies, like, you know, and then plus also is, oh, you know, hopefully we'll be really sad when an ant gets squished. But instead, you know, ants bite dudes and he's like, ah, and the ant's still clearly alive. It was like G.I. Joe when every time a Cobra ship got blown up, you always saw a parachute come out afterwards. You never saw an ant get squished the entire time. I felt like it was almost everything
there's
about
some
this.
Lambs that got
there's some what?
Lambs that certainly did.
Man, which scene is that? I'm blank. Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, when they miniaturize the lamb. I felt like it was 2/3 of the way towards 3 different movies, each of which I would have really, really liked. Instead, I got Ant-Man, which it was all right. It was good. I'm glad, you know, I don't want my money back or nothing. And I'm glad it's part of the, you know, overall cinematic universe. I'd rather have Ant-Man than not have Ant-Man.
I like that they put the heist structure onto the story.
Oh, sure,
which I've heard. I haven't seen it. Well, I'm excited to see that.
And they do. And it is good. It's a good heist. I'll tell you what, though. The superstar of the entire thing one of the things that makes movies really memorable to me is when they do something that I've never seen before and they do it better than I've ever seen it before. And they're definitely in Ant-Man is a single scene that I'm like, I've never seen that done so well. And it takes place in the 80s. And it's when you have old Agent Carter and young Hank Pym in the room together, perfectly, perfectly executed. You remember, like, we almost got that with Tron Legacy, mm-hmm. with, young Kevin Flynn. But being in the theater, maybe it looks better on Blu-ray or whatever, but being in the theater, it's like...
Fantastic.
It was robot-y face, and it felt very CG weird, very uncanny valley, whereas this absolutely passed the test. Like, nice. All of a sudden, it occurred to me, like, holy crap, somebody could make a Michael Douglas movie starring a 40-year-old Michael Douglas today from beginning to end. They could do Fatal Attraction or whatever, and I would never even know that it's not that he's not 40 years old now.
Because that scene is computer age down Michael Douglas, a physical aging up of Haley Atwell for Agent Carter. Then there's bad guy that we're being introduced to and real John Slattery looking like John Slattery as Tony Stark's dad.
Howard Stark.
Old Howard Stark. So it's like you have kind of three different ways, I mean, of these people, and they all it looks like an 80s, a scene set in the 80s. Like it was remarkable.
Yeah, it's like a Turing test for the Uncanny Valley just got passed for the first time. You know, wow. It's like I bought it. And if you showed someone that scene in isolation, they would not recognize anything extraordinary about it at all. Like, oh yeah, no, it's an older woman. It's this younger guy.
Star Chamber? Was this Douglas's? I loved it. I get all of your observations on it, and in the middle of it, I'm kind of going like, well, how do I feel about this or whatever? But like, it was fun. I love Edgar Wright, but I did not want to see Edgar Wright do a Marvel movie. I did not want Edgar Wright to kind of pop a hole in the Marvel universe and do a farce or do something that was just this. How does this fit there? Not to say it wouldn't have been a great movie, but I liked this. I thought it was very, very comedic. I was worried because I saw a preview at Disneyland a couple months ago that fell flat to me, and it's a lot of people talking in a house, a lot of this. But as Jason pointed out, thank God they used a heist structure. Thank God we got away from the what's it. There was still a what's it, but yeah. It was more of a we need to get the what's it, not stop. You know, you look at the plot of both Avengers movies, Thor the Dark World, which I loved, by the way, but still how they're all the same thing on paper. And that was the same as like Transformers 2, you know, which was when Avengers came out. I'm like, man, like I saw the same plot in Transformers, in the last Transformers movie, you know, and some of the same creatures, you know. But I like that they did it different. I like the stuff with Michael Pena with his humor and the way that played in. I was glad to see that in the Marvel Universe they could go a little bit more, you know, tongue-in-cheek, which reminded me of like, okay, this is like the Marvel comics. Some of them are going to be a bit more goofy than others, you know, yeah. But it's just more of kind of has to do with the people around them and the way they act, not so much that the rules are different or the rules are more goofy. And so I thought that it did a very good job.
And I think you make a really good point where it's like the Marvel Cinematic Universe does not need to be a single unified narrative from beginning to end. It needs to be a collaborative patchwork quilt of wildly different stories and archetypes and villains and heroes that somehow, you know, that just, and again, a quilt's a good metaphor because, you know, we're not fooled into thinking that this sheet was all manufactured at once, you know, or that this blanket was all made at once. Like, this is clearly made of a bunch of wildly different materials on there. Yeah. And I think there's a place for that.
And my test of it is like, could we take a scene out of here and put it into another Marvel movie and you still go, okay, I feel like I'm in the same universe. I'm in a different, you know, I'm in Santa Monica. I'm not in Chicago, you know, or I, you know, this is when people are kind of, I'm with, you know, funnier people instead of dour people or whatever, but does it fit that? And not to say that they might do in Marvel comic movies or Marvel movies, like trailer sequences or maybe two of them. But if they did hypothetically, and one of them might have been from a totally different Marvel movie, but you'd go, yeah, no, this still fits. I think these worlds are connected.
Were you speaking over my head? Were you talking about Fantastic Four there or
no, talking about the end credit scene at the end of Ant-Man.
God dog it. I didn't stick around.
They keep all right. Screw you. Screw all of you because you can't train me to stick around till after the credits and then stick a fist up my butt in Avengers 2 and not deliver and then say like, no, dude, we're not doing sticking around till after our credits again. And then turn around and mock me because I didn't stick around for the credits after being trained to not stick around for the credits. I'm done with this BS of being teased about whether or not to stick around for the credits.
If only there was a thing called the internet where you could just look and say,
dude, I ain't checking no internet to be like, oh, golly, I'm going to see a movie. Should I stick around for the credits before this? You're going to make an app for that? You're going to make an Apple Watch thing that buzzes, says it looks like you're watching Ant-Man. You might want to stick around for after the credits. No, that's dumb. I'm done. I'm out. The movie's over. I'm out of there.
So what you're saying is that you participated in the parade of suckers.
Sure. No, you know what? Y'all's the suckers sitting around for
that's
everything.
That's you, old color guard brushwood, just leading the parade of suckers out of the theater.
No, dude, I'm opting out. The movie ends when the credits start. That's the law.
You're drawing a line in the sand.
That's right. And I'm going to squish.
That's what's happening.
I'm going to squish any ants that come over that line in the sand. I'm taking Andrew Main's advice. I'm buying a steamroller. I'm going to crush all of them. What's that?
Do you want to know what you missed?
What did I miss?
There's actually a really fun story to it. It's actually really rad.
Well, let's hear it.
Tell them what the scene was.
So the scene, spoiler alert for anybody who has not seen the movie.
Me. Who didn't. Or people who watched the movie but didn't stick around till after the credits.
So it's Cap and Falcon and just completely dropped into it. Bucky is caught in a vice with his metal arm in this gigantic robot vice. It's just like this. You're completely put in.
We just came into the middle of some other movie.
I think it's actually a scene from Civil War.
So they're like, hey, should we call Stark? And Captain's like, no, we can't do it right now. We just need to make sure that we get in there without killing him. And Falcon just looks at Cap and says, I know a guy. And then it says Ant-Man will return in Civil War. So that's an actual scene from the dailies of Civil War that they're shooting now. And Kevin Feige saw it and was like, this would be great as a bumper for Ant-Man. And I thought it was kind of really cool to just do an end little tease thing that wasn't just fanboy.
Did you see the Wasp tease, Brian?
I did see that. Okay. Well, again, I happened every other time. You know, I was like, oh, good. They did me the courtesy of giving me the little extra giblet at the end instead of making me sit through credits first. Yeah. I'm done. I'm out. If I see a single name, I'm out of there.
All right, Brian, we all understand. You left the theater. It's fine. No one's going to make fun of you anymore. But you don't need to unleash your holy jihad on the concept of after trailer stingers.
Look, the stinger trailer was Captain America: Civil War in its entirety.
God, talk about
it. Yeah, just played the movie.
I don't care if it's freaking erotic slash fiction being acted out by the actors afterwards. I ain't gonna stick around for it. I see a single key grip. I'm out of the theater. That's my new law.
Gentlemen, let's just. We're running long here. Let's say our pick is Ant-Man and stay for the end.
Yeah, no, I agree. Stay. Be a better man than me. Stay for the end.
Ants. Weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.